Well, good morning. We're going to get started here today, continuing in our study of the book of Genesis. And remember, of course, as we're doing this, we're trying to give you tools to understand the book. We're not trying to go through every single passage, understand every verse. We're trying to give a framework to how to understand the book of Genesis. Last time that we were together, last week, we focused a little bit on just thinking about Moses as being the author of not only Genesis, but also the Pentateuch as a whole. That's the first five books of the Old Testament. And then we also just looked a little bit about the structure and outline of Genesis. If you were with us, we emphasized the word genealogy. The Hebrew word is toledot. It appears 10 times. Properly speaking, 11, but two of them are tied together in the book of Genesis, and it divides up the book into a number of sections. And we just kind of left off emphasizing that Moses, as he wrote Genesis, is not just like slapping stories together haphazardly, right? He has carefully constructed the narrative to teach us some truths, all right? So we talked a little bit about that together. We noted that there is a narrowing process throughout the book of Genesis where we begin with Adam, and then we go down to Noah's sons, Shem, Terah, who's the father of Abraham, then Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And there's this movement down to focusing on the people of Israel, whom God was going to work through, ultimately, we know, to bring about his redemptive plans for the world. Now, so that's kind of where we left off, and now we're finally, after a number of weeks laying the groundwork for the book of Genesis, we're actually finally getting into the book itself. And here we go into Genesis 1 and 2. Now, next week, God willing, I'll talk a little bit more specifics about this passage, but here we're going to just kind of take a big picture view about these chapters 1 and 2. And as we think about the subject of creation. And that's what chapters 1 and 2 focus on. They focus on the subject of creation in this text. Now, just as we think about the subject of creation, we need to begin with the existence of God. Genesis is very important for understanding the idea of God. And as we think about this text here, and I'm looking at your notes, which has the blanks in it, and I need to pull up my notes, which don't have the blanks in it. A letter A, the Bible gives no prior argument for the existence of God. Now, this is an old truth, but it's an important truth. In the beginning, God, right? It affirms its existence, God's existence, from the very first verse of Genesis. Only the fool says in his heart, there is no God. Remember that? That's Psalm 14:1. The fool has said in his heart, literally, no God, which both means he tells God, no, I don't do what you want me to do, but also, no, you have no bearing in my life whatsoever. This is not a class on theology proper or the doctrine of God. If it were, we would talk about various ways that people try to prove the existence of God. And there are some helpful things in some of those proofs, but hear this carefully. Ultimately, the Bible just affirms God exists. All right? It just starts that way. And that's an important thing. And if you think about it in the realm of Israel, as she first receives this book, remember, Moses is the guy who writes it, probably writes it somewhere in the wilderness wanderings. He delivers the five scrolls, the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. He delivers it to the people of Israel sometime before he dies and before the people of Israel cross over into Jordan. They have left Egypt, and we can ask this question. In Egypt, was there the idea of just one God? No, not at all. They had a host of gods, lots of gods. Genesis just starts with the premise, God, singular. There is one God. Now, in general, as we think about creation, creation reveals a number of truths about God. First of all, it reveals God's wisdom and power. His wisdom and power. Proverbs 3:19 talks about that by the wisdom of God, the foundations of the earth were laid. And Job indicates the same idea in Job 28, verses 25 through 28. Also, creation reveals the glory of God. Glory here referring to the totality of God's splendor and majesty. The whole of his person is displayed. Everything about God's glory is displayed. The heavens declare the glory of God. Psalm 19. Similarly, creation also reveals this about God. God's eternal power and divinity or divine nature. That's what Paul claims in the New Testament. It's Romans 1, 18 through 21. Also, creation reveals God's love for insignificant man. And what we mean by that is, remember in Psalm 8, Lord, our Lord, how excellent is your name in all the earth. You have set your glory above the heavens. When I consider the work of the heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and stars, all that stuff that you've made. And remember the question that the psalmist asked, what is man that you are mindful of him? And the son of man that you're going to even think about it, you're going to consider him. When you think about the splendor of all of the created order. I mean, anybody do any time the geeking out of the latest edition of the telescope that's been sent, telescopes that are sent up into space and just looked at the vastness of the universe? I mean, you just look at the pictures and you realize how tiny we are. But you don't even have to look into space to see that, right? I was looking out here just a few weeks ago at some of the pictures from various places around the world for New Year's Eve celebrations. Of course, it's done all over the world. And you see some of these places where you have packed into a small area, literally hundreds of thousands of people. And they're just jammed in there. When you see pictures of that from high above, when we think about Times Square is actually small compared to some of the celebrations that happen around the world on New Year's Eve. And you see hundreds of thousands of people. And all you see is just like a mass of colors, right? What they're wearing. You don't see individuals. You realize even just in that how puny we are. One New Year's Eve celebration, I remember a long time ago, I was 12 years old. My uncle was getting married. And after the wedding, reception was held in downtown Denver, Colorado, at a place called the Brown Palace. And the Brown Palace, that sounds really boring, the Brown Palace, but it was like one of the swankiest places you could go, and why her family decided to have a wedding on New Year's Eve and then try to rent that facility out. I was told at that time, so that's like 30 years ago now, I was told at that time that the wedding reception cost $20,000. Okay, so put that in today's terms, you realize that wasn't an insignificant chunk of change. They had a small room up high. The Brown Palace was a place for meetings. It had a beautiful marble floor with a huge rotunda that extended up like six stories. This crystal chandelier that, was like two stories tall at the top of this, and we were up by that. And there was a huge New Year's Eve party that was going on down there. And several times we went out of the space that we were in, and I'd look down, and you'd see all of these very rich and famous people dancing down there. And there was like, I was told the governor of the state was there, and John Elway, who was the quarterback and soon to be owner of the part owner of the Denver Broncos, was there. I mean, there's, it was lifestyles of the rich and famous that were all down there, right, going on. And I'm 12 years old, and of course, my mom's like, wow, you should have seen the van that our family drove there, by the way. That's a story in and of itself, having that valet parked, right? That the bumper was being held on by a bungee cord. I'm not kidding. So we're there in this presence, but you look down and you see all of these supposedly rich and important people, and I couldn't pick out any of them. They were just small, right? That's just from one limited perspective. And so when we think about creation and the power of God that's at display here, it shows that God actually does care about individual, insignificant man. In fact, as we'll see, humanity, Adam and then Eve, are the crowning glory of the created order. And that's astounding when you think about all that God does here in these chapters. And finally, we also see God's providential care. Number five, God's providential care. This is actually just worth looking at. This is a little, I think you'll know this text, but sometimes we forget about it as it relates to creation. Isaiah 40, let's just go there for a moment. Isaiah 40, verses 21 through 26. And here we see God's providence, his care over the whole of the created order. There's these powerful questions that are asked. Verse 21, have you not known? Have you not heard? Has it not been told you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundations of the earth? So here we're reflecting on the core of the earth. It is he, speaking of God, who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretches out the heavens like a curtain. He spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. He brings the princes to nothing. He makes the judges of the earth useless. Scarcely shall they be planted. Scarcely shall they be sown. Scarcely shall their stock take root in the earth, when he will also blow on them, and they will wither, and the whirlwind will take them away like stubble. To whom then will you liken me, or to whom shall I be equal? Says the Holy One, talking about God here. Lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these things, who brings out their host by number. He calls them all by name, by the greatness of his might and the strength of his power. Not one is missing. Yesterday at the men's breakfast, I don't know how we got on the subject of barcodes. For those of you here, remember this? Like, talking about like how many different possibilities there are and the number of things to itemize and order and to keep track of things in the world. You know, like every year, you know, sometime around, you know, you have these companies that come in and do inventory for places to try to keep track of how much stuff you have. Anybody have trouble with that just in the stuff in your kitchen? Like keeping track where things are, right? You know, oh, moved, you know. Oh, I did, you know, like sometimes, have you ever done that too? Where it's like, somebody move this, and you realize, oh, I was the guy who did that and put it in the wrong place, right? We lose track of all these things. And Isaiah, under the inspiration of God, as he's reflecting on God's creative power, he's saying that God not only formed this stuff, he keeps track of everything. You know, everything has a number to God. He knows where it is. And in fact, he can name everything, right? He can do that with his power. So what's interesting about all of these texts that we're mentioning and these ideas, Proverbs and Psalms, Romans, Psalms again, and Isaiah, is each one of these authors is reflecting upon the creation narrative and drawing out truths that come from it. All right, so what that means is that as we study Genesis, we can draw from the creation narrative theological, doctrinal truths about God, how God acts, what he's like, and how he views us. And so it's worth thinking about that. Genesis 1 and 2 help the people of Israel and us to understand something about God and how God views our place in the created order. So these texts are very, very important for all of this. Now, with that said, let's get into the creation account itself. So just some general remarks here. First of all, these two chapters do not give a single chronological story of the creation, should read of the creation there, but two complementary stories. This suggests that the author had a particular purpose in mind for each of these stories. Now, let's talk about a couple of things here when we use the word story. When I use the word story, you've heard me say this before, I don't mean like fairy tale made up story. Stories can be true or they can be fiction. In this case, they're true stories. Okay? They're true stories. But if you read Genesis 1 all the way down through chapter 2 and verse 4, that is one account of the creation. Then if you go into chapter 2 and verse 5 and following all the way down to the end of chapter 2, you have a second account of creation. Right? There are two different ways of telling the true story of how God created everything. And they complement each other. In a similar way, that if you have like a favorite historical figure that you like to read good biographies on, If you got somebody you really like, you know, I'm told that, for instance, Winston Churchill has over like 1,000 published biographies of him. I've read one. Okay. Maybe I'll read another one. He's a very consequential figure for our age today. But somebody who wants to know something about Winston Churchill might read a couple of those biographies to get some different perspectives on him. And they, if they're good ones, they complement each other. They help, right? And the same way here, when you think about what Moses is doing, he has two different ways of telling the creation account, and each one of them focuses on different aspects of God's creation and what God intends to do in creation. That's what we mean by complement. Now, the first, in general, in chapters 1, verses 20, verse 1 through chapter 2, verse 3, it tells the story of creation, the creation of the universe in 6 days, after which God rested. And this story ends, and if you were with us last week, you've heard this word, with the toledot, that is the history of, or the genealogy of, the, in this case, the heavens and the earth. So it ends there. The second chapter, specifically after chapter 2 and verse 3, the second chapter tells the story of creation of man in particular and his place in the Garden of Eden. And this account prepares the reader for the story of man's temptation, his fall, and his exile from the garden. So each one of them are focusing on different aspects of what God does. So in the first one, our emphasis is more on what God has done. In the second one, it's still about God, but it's also focusing on God's creation of humanity. And each one of these complement each other. Now, we do need to address a question about the creation accounts here, okay? Of course, we're going to get into this a little bit here today. Christians historically have had, especially in the last about 150 years, debates about the creation accounts. But one thing we need to affirm is that all believing Christians believe that God created the universe ex nihilo. That's Latin for out of nothing. Out of nothing. So you will, if you ever read a commentary on Genesis, you read anybody who talks about Genesis and the origins of all things who are from a Christian perspective, they have to affirm that God created everything out of nothing. And you'll see that phrase ex nihilo that's used. And by the way, just to be clear, this is like the only Latin phrase that I really know. There might be a couple other ones, okay? So I'm not a Latin speaker, all right? So I don't want to make myself appear more intelligent than I actually am. All right, so out of nothing. But you will run across that in this discussion about the origins in Genesis. So everybody agrees, you have to. In other words, you cannot be a Christian, properly speaking, unless you believe that God created everything out of nothing. Okay, in the beginning, God, then everything else. Right? However, of course, those of you who've been around the Christian block more than a short time, we understand that there is debates about the creation accounts in chapters 1 and 2. Are they representative of literal 24-hour days? How do we deal with modern scientific proposals of the creation of the universe as being the result of billions of years of time? And so we just want to think about that a little bit here, both this week and next week, and just to give you some frameworks of how to understand this. Now, here is the reality today. If we think about broad American Christianity, broad American evangelicalism, all right, here at our church, we have historically held, I hold, I teach, I affirm, we would not want a pastor who didn't believe this. We believe that the creation account describes 24-hour days. Creation was accomplished in 6 24-hour days, and then God rested. So we affirm that. We believe that. All right. You can be a member here in the church and have questions about that, even not sure you believe that. But in terms of leadership, that is what we've been really clear on here for a long, long time. Now, here's the deal. We, by far, if you think about broad American Christianity in terms of church leadership, we by far are in the minority who believe that. Okay? So I'm not trying to pick on schools or anything, But if you are familiar with Trinity Evangelical Divinity School, that's in Deerfield, Illinois, that is the flagship school of the Evangelical Free Church of America. They have a college and a seminary. There are many, many good people there. I buy books from some of their professors, okay? But I have been told by several sources that there is not a single faculty member at that school and at that seminary that believes in six-day literal creationism, okay? All right, so that's just the fact. You go to major evangelical schools like Wheaton in Illinois, Gordon Conwell out east. You go even to many of the Southern Baptist schools. They have more conservative professors there, a number of them who believe in six-day literal creations, but they also have faculties full of people who don't believe that as well. There's debate on that. Even just in general, if you say, well, that's at the school level, how about in the you know, the pastors of churches. I watched actually just recently a scholar lecture at, it was at Wheaton at their Carl F. H. Henry School, and he gave a lecture about this very issue, and he put up survey data that within the E-Free churches that it was just barely over 50% of pastors affirmed six-day literal creation. Okay, I'm not trying to pick on the E-Free, because we could do the same thing with Baptists. I just don't have recent data on that. Okay, so these issues actually are important because they do show up in churches and in church leadership. Okay, so how do we think about this? How do we think about Genesis and modern evolutionary theories? What fits? What doesn't fit with the Bible? Well, historically, Christians have viewed the creation account in one of four ways. The first is, and by historically, let me just back up and say, we're talking modern time periods. Think like 1850s onward. Okay, so let's just be clear about that. All right, we could go back further, but further they viewed creation as largely six literal days. But historically, in the more modern period, the first way that Christians have tried to articulate this is through what's known as the gap theory or the reconstructionist theory. In fact, probably the word reconstruction would be more fair to this viewpoint. The theory's most popular proponent was C.I. Schofield. If you have a Schofield reference Bible, which is a good study Bible, it's a little bit dated these days, but it's still got tons of good material in it. C.I. Schofield articulates this view. He held to the gap theory. He held to the reconstructionist theory. He believed that the earth was millions of years old. Okay, so he articulated that. If you can go in the footnotes of his first chapters, and he moderately points to that, but if you go elsewhere, you'll find that it was very, very clear on believing this. Okay, now please don't misunderstand me. That doesn't mean that if you have a Schofield reference Bible, you should go home and burn it. I think it's a great tool. It just means that some things you have to remember, that all those notes, those aren't written by God. Those are written by people. And sometimes the people don't write exactly what God actually said. Okay, we always are to test the spirits, as John says. Now, the gap theory, or the reconstructionist theory, proposed that there is a time interval, or a gap, in the biblical account between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. Okay, so let's just, you know, if we're reading it, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Gap. Long period of time. And then it says, the earth was without form and void, and darkness was on the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters. And so this theory looked and said, hey, look, it says that God created the heavens and the earth, and then all of a sudden, after God's creation of the heavens and the earth, we have all of a sudden the earth being without form and dark and void. It's a primordial, you know, a watery, dark place that isn't actually fully put together. That was kind of the look here towards that. So according to this theory, verse 1 tells about the original creation of all things by God. Then, during the time gap, there was a revolt of angels, which led to their exiles on earth, resulting in its ruin. This is why the earth is without form and void. Do I have this in your notes? Okay. This is why the earth was without form and void in verse 2. So notice that it claims that there's a revolt of the angels. They say that's when Satan fell and brought, you know, roughly a third of the angelic forces with him. They're exiled on the earth. They destroy things. They wreck things. And then the following verses show how God rebuilt the heavens and the earth. And they say that in the interval between these first two verses, there may have been a very long period of time which would erase the difficulty between the Bible and certain aspects of science. And Scofield and others, and this was for a long time, it's largely abandoned today, but Scofield and others, they quoted and they cited, and we'll talk about these texts here in just a moment, Jeremiah 4, Isaiah 24, and Isaiah 45 to support these theses. In fact, does anybody have a Scofield reference Bible? I think it actually shows that in the footnote on the bottom there.
On the bottom of
what's that?
Footnote on the bottom.
Genesis 1, I think between like 1:1 and 2. I think he actually uses in that. What do we got? I should have brought mine with. See, I do have one. All right, so that was my first study Bible. I used it in high school all the way through college. It's a great tool. A lot of stuff I appreciate about it. This is just one area. Unfortunately, it's on the first page that he gets it wrong. All right.
Very true.
Is it footnoted there, Scott?
I don't see. He's got a lot of footnotes, but not a...
All right. It might show up in Jeremiah. So that's the argument. Okay, so a little more. What does this view argue for? Well, this view argues that the adjectives shapeless and empty signify an imperfect world, and it is impossible that God created something imperfect. Okay? So you see, New King James translation is without form and void, shapeless and void. Those are both good translations there. And so they say, it says God created everything, but it's without shape, it's void. Those are negative terms. God couldn't have created something that's not perfect. All right? So therefore, it means that something is wrong with it. Now, what do we do with that argument? Well, first of all, I just want to explain that the words without form and empty does not have to mean that something is morally wrong. For instance, let's take a potter, and he starts with a lump of clay. And he or she, they throw that down on their potter's wheel, you know, they get it. A little water in their hands, and there's that lump. Is there something wrong, imperfect, about what the potter has there at that point? No, not at all. There's nothing. Now, he's got intentions to do something with it, right? There's nothing wrong. And then they begin to take their hands, right, and they start to form it as the wheel's spinning, and they shape it, and they do all those things. You know, halfway through, is there something like morally incomplete about that? No, it's not. When we use the word imperfect, we can use that in a couple of different ways. We can talk about something being imperfect morally, or we just mean it's not yet finished, right? So the phrase is without form and empty do not necessarily mean that something is wrong with it. It may in fact be that God created the heavens and the earth and intended to shape and fill it, and that process is part of the goodness of creation. In fact, if you go back to like, and this is still true today, if you go back to like very, very old Christian thinkers, like St. Augustine, you know, that name, you know, 4th century BC, Augustine postulated actually the greatest miracle of creation was not that God created out of nothing, is that he could actually stretch it out over 6 days. Because he's like, you know, like he was actually able to, you know, shape day after day the created order. And that's actually not a crazy thought, right? So there's nothing like immoral or imperfect in that sense. It's kind of a bad argument to begin with. Now, the Bible does tell... Remember we said that this is the argument says that there was angels and they, you know, they fell and they brought chaos. The Bible does tell of the fall of angels and their judgment. And The expressions tohu and bohu, those are the words without form and empty, do refer to the results of God's judgment in some of those texts. And since these are judgment words, this view says, this must indicate that judgment happened. So here's the argument. The argument says, without form and void, they're used in passages that describe the angels when they fell. And therefore, since Moses also used those words in Genesis 1, that they must be talking about the same thing. And since it meant judgment over here in the passage about angels, therefore it must mean some form of divine judgment in Genesis 1. Now let's just ask a basic question. Is that the way language actually works? That if you use a set of words in one context, it must mean the same thing in another context. It does not. But that literally is the argument. So they look at texts like these in Jeremiah and so on, and they try to import these ideas. Let's just look at one to show why this is really a bankrupt idea. Let's go to Jeremiah 4 for a second. Jeremiah 4. I'm harping on this one in particular, not because so many people believe it anymore, but this one was popular for a long time in the United States.
Coming back.
Is it coming back?
Somebody just sent me a whole thing on that particular view that they were learning in their church, so it's coming back.
That's interesting. It wouldn't surprise me. There's nothing new under the sun. Jeremiah 4... And I'm talking and not actually turning to my passage here, so give me a second. You're all ahead of me. Actually, while I'm turning there, can somebody read verses 23 through 26 for me? Who can do that? Thank you, Dorothy.
I looked on the earth, and behold, it was formless and void, and to the heavens, and they had no light. I looked on the mountains, and behold, they were quaking, and all the hills moved to and fro. I looked, and behold, there was no man, and all the birds of the heavens had fled. I looked, and behold, the fruitful land was a wilderness, and all its cities were pulled down before the Lord, before his fierce anger.
All right, now here is a text that you see those exact words that are used in Genesis 1, formless and void, or without form and void. And the argument is, see, these words are used in terms of judgment. They're used in judgment. Now, when you look at verses 23 through 26, you might be tempted to think, oh, that looks like a lot like the things that are mentioned in creation. You have birds, you have darkness, you've got, you know, without form and void, you've got the mountains that are shaking. All right, so this must be talking about the original creation. However, all we need to do is look in the context here just a little bit. So if we go back to verse number 19, we see the context of what's going to happen, what Jeremiah is talking about. O my soul, I am pained in my very heart. My heart makes a noise in me. I cannot hold my peace because you have heard, O my soul, the sound of a trumpet, the alarm of war. Destruction upon destruction is cried, for the whole land is plundered. Suddenly my tents are plundered and my curtains in a moment. How long will I see the standard and hear the sound of the trumpet? For my people are foolish. They have not known me. They are silly children. They have no understanding. They are wise to do evil, but to do good they have no knowledge. Now, what's the context here of what Jeremiah is saying? Well, he's talking about, remember, Jeremiah is called the weeping prophet, and he's weeping because he sees the destruction that is going to come upon the people of Israel. So then he poetically goes back to Genesis 1 and talks about when God began to create the heavens and the earth, that he started with this formless void shape that he creates and fills. What you actually have going on in here in Jeremiah is Jeremiah saying poetically, just as God had power to create, God has power to uncreate. And he's going to wreck Israel. And by the way, isn't that what he did? I mean, God brought in foreign powers that just obliterated everything, first in the north in Samaria and then in Judah in the south. And that's what God did. So he's poetically saying, God who created all things, started from formless and void to create something beautiful, he can uncreate in a moment. That's his power. He's not actually saying this is how the earth came to be by some sort of evolutionary process. He's poetically appealing back, and he's using those words, formless and void, to remind how things started. And furthermore, you also get the sense as you read on past verse 26 that this there's future realities here. Notice how he says this, verse 27, "For thus says the Lord, the whole land shall be desolate, yet will I not make a full end. For this shall the earth mourn, and the heavens above be black, because I have spoken, I have purposed, I will not relent, nor will I turn back. The whole city shall flee from the noise of the horsemen," and so on. You see this picture of just total warfare coming in and destroying the people. So Jeremiah is not about how old the earth is. It's not about the process of evolutionary creation or some sort of gap interval between Genesis 1 and 2. But this was a text that was used to support this idea. The same, by the way, you can find, if you took time, you can find the same thing in Isaiah 24 and Isaiah 45 as well. So here, their argument is these words always mean judgment, and that isn't necessarily true. That's not how language works, and you can see Deuteronomy 32 for an example of that. And furthermore, I don't think it fits with texts like Jeremiah. Another argument they make is that the verb was in verse 2, that's Genesis 1 in verse 2, can be translated as became. All right? Which implies a degradation of an originally perfect creation. Just in general, that's their argument. According to most experts, this translation is forced, and it seems to have been adopted not for word linguistic reasons, but just to support this theory. And in fact, you can cross-reference Jonah 3, verse 3 is a clear example where this exact construction is used, and it's not at all used in this became sense. Number four, the order given man to fill the earth, they say, means to fill again, which it means that it was stocked before and emptied afterwards. That's their argument. But the normal Hebrew reading of this verb simply is to fill. That's all it means, just to fill. Now, we'll end with a summary paragraph. This theory seems to satisfy only those who propose it. Scientists have not found any of these three steps. In other words, even if you believe this is true, it doesn't actually answer the scientific questions because it doesn't fit with all the evolutionary supposed data today. So it doesn't work both scientifically and it doesn't work biblically. Of course, all Bible students recognize the fall of Satan and the fall of the angels, but they find nowhere that the fall was related to the creation in the manner indicated. And as I say, there almost no one believes this. Apparently, there are some people that do believe it, but you will find it in Schofield Reference.
One of the big arguments, too, against it is that that was God's original intent, is to have the angelic host rule and have dominion over the world. Then in the eschaton, in the end, that's what he would restore, but he doesn't. He doesn't restore it to the angels. He restores it to man because it never was theirs.
Yeah.
And so God would be a failure if he didn't complete his original intent to give it to the angels.
So that's a good theological argument. If you didn't hear that in the back, Scott was saying that if you say that God started with the angels, they're judged. That means that God would have, in some sense, failed in his creation project. Because with mankind, man fails, and God intends to restore them fully to dominion over the earth. No such thing is given to the realm of the angels. All right, so we spent a long time on that one. We'll spend a very short time on the day-age theory and a little bit longer on what's called the framework or literary theory, and then we'll get to what we think the scriptures actually hold, and we'll try to do that next week. Thank you so much. You've listened well, and we'll get ready for our morning service. You are dismissed.